This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
you can see youth on the tarmac at the airport kind of just jumping around and shouting honoraries to him, saying Baba Oyoyo, which is like Hausa slang, just to kind of celebrate the president's return.
That's Chika Oduwa reporting on the return of President Muhammadu Buhari from London. Details coming up.
Also, the Kenyan government is firing doctors who went on strike 3 months ago and left the healthcare sector in crisis.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the United Nations reports aid workers have succeeded in providing desperately needed food and other humanitarian aid to more than 338,000 South Sudanese facing famine in four key areas of Unity State. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN aid agencies have been scaling up relief operations in famine-stricken Unity State since February 20th, when the UN declared a localized famine in this region of South Sudan. The United Nations reports some of the 100,000 people facing starvation are dying, while another 1 million are on the brink of famine across war-torn South Sudan. Because of security concerns, the World Food Program has been airdropping food, emergency livelihood assistance, nutrition supplements, health and sanitation kits. WFP spokeswoman Bettina Lucia tells VOA airdrops are the only option when truck convoys are unable to go by road to deliver aid.
Famines happen if aid workers don't have access. And that was the issue in those areas. Again and again over the past few years, we were able to avoid a famine in those areas. But these people now for the third time have been in really dire situation and need the outside help. It's crucially important that aid workers get access. And of course, funding is important too.
Spokesman for the Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, agrees. Unfortunately, he says a week after famine was declared in parts of South Sudan, 28 humanitarians were forced to leave Mayandit, one of the hardest-hit areas, following skirmishes north of the town.
Intensive negotiations were undertaking to try to get the aid workers back. They're critically needed in the response. However, renewed fighting has been reported on the outskirts of the town on the 1st of March, and aid organizations, the 28 aid workers, have not been able to return because of the continued fighting.
Lajerke says the UN's life-saving operation also is being hampered by a lack of funds. He says only slightly more than 9% of the $1.6 billion needed to carry out emergency operations this year has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Kenyan government is firing doctors who went on strike 3 months ago and left the healthcare sector in crisis. As Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, the two sides are trying to work out the terms of a collective bargaining agreement covering salaries and other matters.
Kenyans remain in limbo after the government and doctors failed to agree on and sign documents that cover a range of issues, including better pay and working conditions for the doctors, improved health facilities and security for medical staff. Peter Munya is the governor of the state of Meru and chairman of the Council of Governors. He says the government remains firm in its decision to penalize doctors who refuse to return to work.
The decision we took still stands, and I'm told there are processes. People are now following processes of laying off those who have not reported back to work. I'm told like Embu now already notices have been given. So that is what we are implementing.
On Wednesday, the biggest hospital in the country, Kenyatta National Hospital, fired 12 medics and put 48 others on notice. Kenyan media report a handful of physicians returned to work. Dr. George Goat is with the union that represents the doctors. He says it is National Advisory Council agreed to propose amendments presented in a collective bargaining agreement that now awaits the signature of both parties.
I can only confirm that we were told that the CBA will be signed with amendments. I'll not tell you exactly which amendment because that is fairly confidential. So the third document to be signed is a formal return to work formula setting out the procedures of returning to work.
Dr. Ogot says the union has yet to receive word whether the government will sign the documents, but that union officials remain optimistic. The government had taken the step of arresting union officials in an effort to end the strike, even as the doctors refused to back down.
National Advisory Council remain committed, and so far we've not received any communication that those documents will not be signed. We are just waiting for our negotiators to brief us. As and when they sign and they advise us to resume work, we already gave them our blessing and we shall resume work.
Governor Munya confirmed to VOA that changes were made to the previous collective bargaining agreement of 2013, in which doctors sought a pay raise of up to 180%. The government's offer stands at 40%. Munya says the government is considering hiring foreign doctors.
We want to start now working out the process of hiring doctors from outside the country. And the Minister for Health is already working on that. He's already exploring diplomatic channels to start talking to friendly countries that can provide doctors. And then he's also working on the legal framework to register these doctors locally.
This is not the first time the government has announced a plan to fire doctors and bring in physicians from abroad. The state plans to hire physicians from neighbouring Tanzania, as well as Cuba and India. Before that happens, an appeals court will have to rule on the matter. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari returned home today after spending 51 days in London. A press release describes the trip as a vacation, but adds Buhari's health had improved significantly following the medical attention he received. Rumors actually had been circulating that he was either dead or incapacitated. The Nigerian leader pledged to rededicate himself to the service of the nation. Reporter Chika Adua is following developments. From Abuja, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the reaction to Buhari's return.
Definitely mixed reactions. On one end, a lot of his supporters, mostly in northern Nigeria, there was a lot of jubilation, especially at the airport in Kaduna, which is where he arrived, make it approximately 7 a.m. local time. You can see youth on the tarmac at the airport kind of just jumping around and shouting honoraries to him, saying Baba, Oyoyo, which is like Hausa slang just to kind of celebrate the president's return. And on another hand, there is some uncertainty and some anxiety because he still seems quite ill. So we're still not sure how long he will not be able to handle his duties because he says that he will continue to allow the vice president to remain in charge.
In a statement released by the special advisor to the president, it says that his health had improved significantly following the medical attention he received during his vacation in London. Is there any word on what he was being treated for?
There is no word at all. The government officials have been using the word vacation as opposed to medical leave. But we do know that he was supposed to be away for just 10 days, and that stretched into 51 days. And all we know is that he was in London doing some medical examinations and that his doctors requested that he remain in London to make sure that more tests were done. Last year, he was in London for an ear infection treatment. We're not sure if this is related to that or something more serious. But all we can do at this point is just to guess, you know, wonder what exactly is ailing the president.
So is the vice president handling most of the duties?
That's correct. He's handling most of the duties, including trying to turn around the economic downturn that has been plaguing the country. He's been getting a lot of commendation, actually, for being able to take charge during Buhari's absence. So he will continue to remain in that role until Buhari says that he is able to resume office.
So this raises the question of whether he would seek another term in office or whether the vice president might become his party's nomination. Is there any talk about that going on now?
There is a lot of talk as far as what's going to happen. There are a lot of political maneuvering amongst the political elite of Nigeria in the ruling party and the opposition party in case Buhari is not able to stand for re-election in 2019.
everyone is wondering, will Buhari be able to run again? There are some people trying to say that the vice president should go ahead and step in that role. And so they're now looking to see who the vice president would be in case the current vice president steps in to run as the president. So a lot of political maneuvering is happening in Nigeria.
What can you tell me about the vice president, Yemi Osinbajo?
Well, the vice president is kind of a newbie when it comes to Nigerian politics. You know, he's not a career politician. He's a trained lawyer, very educated. He's amongst the highest rank of lawyer in Nigeria, which we call a senior advocate. The highest office he's ever held was a state commissioner in Lagos. He's actually a pastor, a Christian pastor, in one of the Pentecostal churches here in Nigeria. They decided to put him, a Christian pastor, as the running mate to Buhari, who was a Muslim from the north. So that balance of regional and a religious power has to always be considered in Nigeria. So the vice president definitely fits that role. He moves around with people from different ethnic groups, from different religious backgrounds. And so some people say he's quite exposed, and they think that he's very much fit to remain as acting president.
That's reporter Chika Adua from Abuja. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
In the mud of a Cairo slum, a giant statue of ancient Egypt's most powerful and celebrated ruler has been discovered. Ramses II, also known as Ramses the Great, ruled Egypt 3,000 years ago. The nation's antiquity ministry calls the discovery of the 8-meter-tall statue one of the most important ever. The statue, which was found in pieces, is made of quartzite. It was found in the Mataria neighborhood among unfinished buildings and mud roads. More discoveries are expected to be made in the area. Associated Press reports giant statues of Ramses II also can be found in Luxor and in Abu Simbel near Sudan.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Aid workers have succeeded in providing desperately needed food to thousands of South Sudanese facing famine. The Kenyan government is firing doctors who went on strike 3 months ago and left the healthcare sector in crisis. And after spending 51 days in London, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari returned home today. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The residents of Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, owe the local government millions of dollars in unpaid bills. After fruitless efforts to recover the debt, the city council handed over bills to debt collectors. They've been issuing notice letters to residents. Some argue the debt is inflated. Reporter Kujazi Zvinavashi reports.
The Harare City Council has often been accused of poor service delivery, something the government blames on the failure of the public to pay their bills. Tendai Kwenda is acting finance director at the council.
Our debtors' book is growing every month. We are currently on 615 million, an average of 24 million a month. Our collection efficiency is about 45 to 50%. People in Harare are not meeting their obligations to council. The same council to provide services. I don't know how.
Some parts of Harare have not received any water for years, including the high-density suburb of Mavuku. Resident James Mahach lives there.
We have not been using tap water or running water for the past 24-plus years. They are continuing to bill us.
The Combined Harare Residents Association is one of the organizations that have been helping communities that have been served with letters of demand. Mfundo Mlilo is chief executive of the organization.
The first issue is on issue of legitimacy of the debt and then also the legitimacy of the means of collection. Some debts are not true debts. So, for example, you have areas like Mabvuku, like Greendale, like Borodale, where water has not been coming out. And yet, because the city of Harare uses estimates, your bill keeps on growing. But in actual fact, You don't owe the city any money because you have not received any service.
In 2014, a full council meeting resolved to end fixed charges in areas that were not receiving water. Munyaradzi Kufaha Kutizwi is a councillor in Harare.
In 2014, I think sometime in June, we got a clear council resolution that areas bordering Tafara, Mabvuku, Heathcliff, the Borodio, they be exempted from paying in terms of water rates. So we have a resolution to that effect. That resolution has not been implemented.
The council says the use of debt collectors has been effective, with most debtors now making an effort to pay their debts. Most critics have argued the use of debt collectors is intimidating and uncalled for. In the past, build up to the elections, the Minister of Local Government, the mother body of all councils in Zimbabwe, has forgiven debts. Nlilo says this has its disadvantages.
There's a culture that has been created that the government will come in and will scrape the fee. So it's the problem of government. They've created this crisis of expectation that people expect that their bills will pay. The problem arises because I was paying my bills and then someone was not paying their bills. Then all of a sudden we are all at par. So the person who was paying no longer pays now because they're also anticipating that the bills would what? Will be scrapped in 2018. We opposed this issue in 2013 because we knew the consequences it would create.
Kwenda agrees with Mlilo.
We've had people that have not bothered to pay a single penny since the last debt write-off. That was in June 2018 and we're in 2017. It's almost 4 years.
The scraping of debt has largely been part of a political campaign by Zimbabwe's ruling party, ZANU-PF. But the move to write off debt has often crippled council operations. In Harare, the councillors belong to the main opposition party, Movement for Democratic Change. The shortcomings of the council, often fueled a lack of money, has resulted to a drop in the local popularity of the opposition party. This is Kudzai Zunawashe, reporting for Voice of America from Harare.
The World Health Organization says about 500,000 Africans die of cancer each year, but the WHO says many lives can be saved with early detection and treatment. From Washington, reporter William Eagle has the story.
The WHO says the leading cancers in Africa affect the breast, cervix, and prostate. Lung cancer, a prominent cause of death in the industrialized world, accounts for only 5% of cases in Africa. Dr. Andre Ilbawi is the technical officer for cancer control at WHO headquarters in Geneva. He says the cause of the illness in Africa is not always clear, though factors that may contribute to breast cancer include alcohol use, obesity, and lack of physical activity. Weakened immune systems also play a role. They are susceptible to many diseases, including cervical cancer, which is often caused by the human papillomavirus, or HPV.
The women in Africa have a higher rate of HIV, and HIV exacerbates or makes worse the effect of HPV, human papillomavirus. So we see the combination of those infectious causes really can explain the majority of cervical cancer cases in Africa and elsewhere.
Ilbawi says besides HPV, other infections can also lead to cancer.
We know that the immune system has a very important role in fighting cancer, and also in some situations, infections can directly cause cancer themselves. So having a strong immune system, we know, contributes to keeping a cancer risk low. It's not always as easy as saying malaria, for example, triggers cancer years down the line for someone who had an exposure to malaria. But we do know that there are very much some cause and effects for infectious causes of cancer on the continent of Africa. Some include, as I mentioned, that human papillomavirus that contributes to cervical cancer. Hepatitis B and C contribute to liver cancer. There are infections in the stomach that can contribute to gastric cancer. So infections, both directly and by weakening the immune system, can contribute to cancer cases.
Not all cancers are fatal, especially if they are detected early. The WHO is working to encourage governments to adopt measures that are low cost but high impact, especially on the local or primary care level.
Early diagnosis has a strategic position in health expenditures because if we are able to detect cancer early, then the costs of treatment are lower. We know from high-income countries, for example, that detecting cancer at a stage one or stage two reduces the cost of treatment in a significant way, between 2 to 4-fold in some settings.
He also says earlier detection makes it likely that less toxic medications can be used. WHO guidelines suggest inexpensive ways to improve cancer detection, beginning by educating the public and health workers on how to recognize potential symptoms.
But we need that person, that provider, to identify high-risk symptoms and say to a patient, I understand that you're having bleeding in your stool or a new mass or a new lump that's concerning to you, and it's also concerning to me. This may be cancer. This may not be cancer. This could be many other possible diseases. But what you need to do from here is get to the secondary level, get to the diagnostic facility so you can have access to biopsy and pathology to confirm whether or not it's cancer. Yeah. And that first-level provider is critical because that's where most patients go first. And we have to bring those providers into the health system for cancer, not just focus on developing high-cost treatment at a centralized facility when most people are either unable to get to that facility, can't afford those treatments, or get there far too late.
Other low-cost options include providing social workers and patient navigators who can help direct patients to facilities that provide blood and tissue testing and treatment. Ildawi says therapies for cancer patients do not have to be costly. They might include surgery, chemotherapy, and oral or hormonal treatments. The WHO advises countries on how to improve cancer care, including providing insurance and other mechanisms that make treatment packages affordable. Ildawi says it's a coordinated effort that includes governments, advocacy groups, the UN, and donors. Together, they help identify where strategic investments can help improve health services and extend the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.